Let's make it happen, Captain.
From deep inside Death Star, I'm Larry Larson.
And I'm Gov Maharaj.
And we are back. We didn't have a show last week because of snowpocalypse. So I was iced in Woodinville.
My car was completely covered in ice.
Yeah, and I thought about doing the show over Skype. I know Dan Fernandez did this week on Channel 9 over Skype one time. But I didn't even have power. I was without power for 4 days.
Same with me.
So I ended up running off the generator. And let me tell you something. While I can play Xbox Live on a generator, it's not as much fun. I'm worried about them.
You had
internet? Gas. Yeah, so I plugged my cable modem into my generator, router into the generator, and then I had Wi-Fi.
Beyond my place, it wouldn't have mattered. There was no power to even get that.
Yeah.
So, yes, while my little alcove of a home was powered, nothing beyond me was powered, so it was like, okay, I am onto an island of myself right now.
Yeah. Well, I seem like I can always get cable, even with the powers out.
Oh,
so
you're lucky.
It's nice. So I have two outputs on the generator. I run one to the TV area, and I run one to the internet area, the router and all that stuff.
Forget your fridge. Forget, you know.
Ah, fridge. Stick stuff outside when it's that cold.
We did the same thing with a cooler. We just filled it up with the snow and put our food outside, and we were golden.
I actually like when it
although
snows.
Not golden snow.
I take the Diet Mountain Dew and just throw it outside on the back porch, and it's always freezing cold, as long as you don't let it freeze. So anyway, let's get started. From Anna, he says, "Hi, Larry and Gove. I love your show. You both are awesome." Now let's just pause on that for a moment and just let that kind of wash over us.
It's your ego that needs stroke.
It is. It says, "I own a Packer Bell notebook, pre-installed Windows Vista Home Premium with D2D. I know about D2D Recovery, which made OEM, which contains OS with bloatwares. I want to access this partition and mod these files like slipstreaming Vista SP1 into it and add software which I use and remove which I don't. Even want to know that how can I make same partition for Windows 7 if I wanted to? This will help me a lot if my OS crashes. I want to restore to a factory as it takes less time. Thank you, too, in advance."
So, one thing that you mentioned there is an acronym, TLAs, three-letter acronyms, DTD, stands for disk-to-disk.
Yeah.
So, you can have different kinds of recovery partitions. You can have one where it's just a single image file there that you use third-party software or, OS software as a WIM file to expand the image and lay it over top. In this particular case, it's literally another partition with the flat files there. So it's basically, a copy job over. There's a lot of different ways to do this. I think what I wanted to do with this one is give you guys an actual show on it, a full show on setting up disk-to-disk recovery, creating your own partition, customizing it, being able to update it. So, that's the other thing that happens with recovery partitions, especially ones from the OEM.
Mm-hmm.
You set up your machine, it came with Win 7 or it came with Vista or something, and it's not like you ever have to recover it in the next month, right?
Yeah.
It's
a
year, 2 years down the line where you have to recover it again, and oh, guess what? You have to put back on all those security updates.
Mm-hmm.
What you really want to have is a system where your recovery partition, you can go to it, relatively continually to keep updating it with security patches.
Yeah.
And what I want to do is actually set up a dedicated show for our wonderful viewers and listeners out there on how to do this.
So we're going to stay tuned. We're going to do this in a couple of weeks, and we'll do a show that's just dedicated to this because it does seem like something that a lot of people tend to want to do.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, and I know I haven't done it before, so it'll be a good learning experience for
involved. It'll be fun. I probably won't touch into it too much, but I can do what I do, which is also set up my images so they're on a backup server.
Yeah.
Right? So that it won't matter what machine that I use. But I tend to stick to very, very similar machines so that if I have to replace it because the hardware goes on it, if it's a laptop, it's kind of difficult to replace a lot of hardware.
Yeah.
You can just slap in another machine, very similar type, restore the image, and you're golden.
Cool. Okay, so stay tuned for that. From Martin, "When I shut down my laptop and it was installing updates, I had to go home at that moment, so I closed my laptop and it went into hibernate during the install of the updates. When I turned on my computer again, it finished installing updates, but when I start my computer, it hangs on the welcome screen for minutes. I've tried to disable all the services that's not Microsoft related, and same with programs under msconfig. It did not make any difference. I also tried with the Saluto program and didn't show any abnormal activity. What do you think is going on here?
So this particular question came in over email, and we did a bunch of discussion on it. And the last one was that he gave me his event logs, and I'm looking over the event logs right now to figure out what's going on. But that question only came in, I believe, yesterday or a couple
yeah.
days ago. So I'm still working on that
one. You're still spending on that one, but the event logs is where you start with this.
Yeah, so I'm basically, you know, when you're starting up, what you want to do is look for the event log entry in your system event log that says, you know, system startup. It's actually by, you know, the event log service
yeah.
starting, right? Is basically when you know that the system is up to a point of doing anything.
Mm-hmm.
Right there is where you want to start taking time snaps in the event log and start looking at, you know, what is the thing or things that are taking the most amount of time. Is a service crashing? Is a service taking a really long time to start up?
Mm-hmm.
The thing that could be happening is kind of a cascade effect. If you have one service that's taking a really long time to start up, and it's depending on other services to start up.
Yeah.
Those ones might be taking a long time. So it kind of has to work in a chain, right? If you have one service that depends on another, that one depends on another, that one depends on another, it has to work its way back, make sure that one, the last one is started, then the next one, then the next one, then the next one, and you can have a compound issue. So
mm-hmm.
where if you're timing out, if a service is crashing, that's what you want to look for in the event logs. And, you know, that's how you can kind of tell when systems are taking a long time is by checking out which dependencies are breaking.
Yeah, and so I suppose, I don't know if Saluto would catch it if Saluto hasn't started yet and something is hung or crashed.
Depending on what kind of technology Saluto uses.
Yeah.
You know, like, it could, in the background, use an ETL boot perf trace.
Yeah.
Just the same way that our normal perf trace tools use it.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you turn on Saluto ahead of time and it knows how to turn on a perf trace
mm-hmm.
and analyze it during a boot up, you can use that too.
Yeah, and I've been using Saluto all the time, and I've been surprised. I didn't notice how many things that I had crashing every week. I just never noticed before. So
like Windows things, third-party things?
Windows Explorer.
Interesting.
So, but I'm doing some kind of weird things here. You know, I got Safe House running with open volumes and stuff like that. So
mm-hmm.
I think that might be one of the things that, I mean, it's nice having the data there to go and try to troubleshoot it now.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So more on that, Martin, when we get to the bottom of that. Another one from Martin Mind. It says, some people are talking about that RAM cleaners clean their memory. Are they actually doing their job, and can those programs do any damage to my system?
So
RAM cleaners. I haven't seen a RAM cleaner in quite a while, personally.
As one of my favorite characters from one of my favorite television shows says, it's a bunch of hokum.
Yeah. So stay away from the RAM cleaners.
They don't do anything. Your RAM isn't dirty.
Yeah.
I mean, to have something be cleaned, it must first be dirty.
Yeah.
And it's not dirty. RAM is there to be used. If you have 12 gigs of RAM, you better darn well hope that all of your RAM is being used and
mm-hmm.
is being used efficiently.
Yeah.
Right? All a RAM cleaner does is it flushes that memory to disk.
Mm-hmm.
So you're hard faulting. You're forcing all of that stuff to be paged out. And then what happens? Oh, you need to access it again. It pages it back in. You're
yeah.
incurring a dramatic perf hit by doing that. It might look nice on some statistics, but in the end, you're not benefiting.
There's no
at all.
Gain.
There's absolutely no gain.
Yeah.
If you have some long-running tasks that are not paging out to disk when it can,
mm-hmm.
If they're allocating a lot of memory and they're not flushing out when they don't need it anymore, then you could have issues where new applications that are trying to allocate memory
yeah.
are not able to do so as efficiently. But really, you're not going to want a RAM cleaner for that. You're going to want to shut down whatever it is that you're not actually using.
Yeah.
Right? So, you know, things that should be in memory are things that you're actively using. If you're not using it, shut it down.
Mm-hmm.
Right? and, you know, get more efficient processes.
So no net gain, long story short, too long, didn't read. No reason to even bother with these. So.
No, and right. Certainly don't pay money for one.
Cool. All right, so we had a question here from McNunn2009. Says, I've learned a lot from the show. Thank you. I'd just like to know more about Silverlight, because I've seen on YouTube people use it as TV and radio. So it sounds like he doesn't know a lot about Silverlight, so let's just give him a quick overview. Silverlight is?
Silverlight is a managed programming environment that is similar to Flash, that's similar to a lot of different technologies.
Has common similarities with Flash.
It has common similarities. It is a nice encapsulated environment in order to run very interactive, high-performance applications, like miniature applications. Mm-hmm. It can run, it's portable within a website, it's portable on your desktop, you program it using XAML.
Yeah. So it runs in and out of the browser.
And it is very well designed for, you know, enriching, interactive, media-style applications, which is why a lot of people use it for delivering video, delivering audio. It's highly efficient.
One of the things that we use Silverlight for on Channel 9 is when we do one of our Channel 9 live events. Mm-hmm. It allows us to stream the video live. So
The video programming aspects to it are very rich. It has dynamic encoding and decoding, so you can shift from a higher bit rate to a lower bit rate based on bandwidth.
Which is very nice when you're watching stuff online.
Yeah, so it can... Netflix uses this behind the scenes as well to deliver it to Windows Media Center.
Yeah.
Uses Silverlight because of the dynamic bandwidth.
And one of the other things that Silverlight does I'm highly impressed with is you can stream 3D. And we both have 3D TVs now. Mm-hmm. So I'm very interested in this. Duncan, someone write in the comments, Duncan, when are we going to have 3D on Channel 9? Because that would be awesome. And I would love to try playing around with that.
Well, we could start doing this.
Yeah, we could start... And I did a 3D thing for Jennifer and Mike Swanson back when they were promoting PDC 08, I think. But it was Anaglyph, red, blue. Mm-hmm. And I want to do something that's like real 3D, even though there's just such a small minority of people would be able to watch it. But it would be very cool. So, yeah, ping Duncan. All right.
Also, just really quickly about Silverlight, we have scores of documentation and samples that you can use. I believe... you just can get Visual Studio Express, which is a free download, and you can start coding up very cool little games, little tools in Silverlight.
And there's no end of Silverlight content on Channel 9, so you can watch John Papa's old shows, you can watch the Coding for Fun stuff. There's lots of examples there if you want to get started with that. Cool. All right, so next question. I often find that I need the full path of a file, and often when that file is on the desktop start menu, i.e. not viewing with Explorer, it's a related question. I'm asking for a solution Explorer. I want solutions that will work everywhere. So they want to get the full path of a file, something that's on their desktop, maybe in the start menu is easy, right-click properties, and you should see the full path there.
Yeah, I mean, if it's on the desktop, again, you know, you can just hold shift, right-click, and say copy as path.
Yeah.
Right, so that's for an icon on the desktop, and you get the full path there. You know, there it is. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, you know, if it's just a file that is being displayed somewhere, it all depends on the application that is being used in order to give you an Explorer reference.
Yeah.
So if you're not hosting, like, an Explorer window, if the app isn't making it visible for you, you're not going to get a perfect experience because you don't know what is backing that
name. So we can't say, here's something that works everywhere, but here's something that works if you're an Explorer or something that you need
on
the desktop.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, next question. Let's see, can you change the icon of a pinned IE9 web application? How do you do it? In IE9, you have the ability to click and drag and open a browser tab to the Windows 7 taskbar and pin the shortcut to the taskbar. This has the effect of creating a pseudo application experience where the shortcut can have its own custom jump list and not grouped with other IE9 browser tabs on the taskbar. Windows uses a shortcut icon or favicon defined in the HTML for the icon on the taskbar. If no shortcut icon is defined, then generic IE shortcut icon is used. If you have a bunch of these pinned to the taskbar and they don't show different icons, it can be confusing the user.
You're
so they
right.
want to be able to change those.
You had a website, didn't you, that was a generic IE icon that you had pinned that... was annoying you?
I did.
I don't know. You don't have it anymore. So it's technically possible to do. Give me a website.
Channel9.mstn.com.
You really want that one? Okay.
Or you can use greengem.com with a J.
Greengem?
Yeah.
What's that?
That's my personal site.
Okay, let's do that.
J-E-M. Of course, I don't update it ever anymore.
Okay.
And it looks really good when you need to install Silverlight. Or Flash, I should say.
So we pin that. Let's go here. Let's close it. We can get the properties to this guy. Okay, let's find that location. It's a relatively, I want to say, complex and yet simple at the same time.
Okay, so you're looking for the location.
Looking for the location of the shortcut.
Okay.
Which is over here.
All right.
Okay, and you want to start up a instance of Notepad. This shortcut is really, you know, just an encapsulated file.
Yeah.
Drag and drop into Notepad. There are two properties that you can add to this file. And let's see. It's called the icon list and the icon index.
Okay.
Let me add Bing to the shortcut list so we can take a look at its version as well. Okay, so the icon file and the icon index of Bing. You can change this, so if you copied it.
So you can have a local path.
You can have a local path, exactly.
And as you know, I think I've mentioned before, I have a directory on my computer that's just icons.
Mm-hmm.
So and by the way, I've been changing the library icons. That's another story, but I'm really into changing icons on folders and things now. But just add those and then put a local path to whatever icon file you want.
Right, and then save it.
Do you know, can you use a PNG or does it have to be an icon?
ICO, JPEG, and I believe PNG can be used.
Okay, cool.
You want to close that, minimize that. Okay, so I saved it and I'm going to copy or move the shortcut to the desktop.
Okay.
I'm going to unpin the old guy.
All right.
And then double-click. And boom, your Larry Larson site now actually has a Bing icon.
Nice.
And then you can now pin it.
And it could be my picture or anything else that you
exactly.
want it to be. It doesn't have to be Bing.
Exactly.
Awesome. Okay. Nice.
And you can pin that guy, and away you go.
Cool. All right. Next question. I've got a new laptop with wireless card that runs Windows 7. At work, I put the laptop in a docking station. It gives the laptop a hardwired internet connection. Functions pretty much like the desktop PC, but there isn't any Wi-Fi signal in my building that I can use, so various portable devices that depend on Wi-Fi for an internet connection are hobbled. I'd like to provide them internet connections without spending more money if possible. So what I'd like to do is install some sort of virtual Wi-Fi router on my PC. Is that possible?
It is totally possible.
With a caveat. You can't be domain joined.
Domain joining may disable it.
Yeah.
Right? So there's policies in place that could disable it. We do it.
Yeah, yeah.
I
couldn't do it here with my laptop.
Right. Your docking station may also, like your machine may need to be configured so that it doesn't disable the Wi-Fi when it's in the docking station,
yeah.
So it's still made active.
Yeah.
And you can use ICS, Internet Connection Services.
Internet Connection Sharing.
Sharing. There you go. I always just go by the acronym, so
yeah.
I know what I'm talking about. You just use ICS, and you can share your Wi-Fi connection across your wired connection, and that's really basically it.
Yeah, super simple. Just hit start, type internet connection, and it should just pop up internet connection sharing. You can just go ahead and set it up there. And as long as you don't have some kind of group policy or
right.
domain join machine that's trying to keep you from doing stuff like that, there's reasons you wouldn't want to do that. You don't want to open up a wide open Wi-Fi that you know,
without authentication,
has your entire network exposed. Yep. So there's reasons why people disable that. But
while it's technically possible to do it, we don't really recommend it.
Yeah.
It's going to actually save yourself a lot of issues in the long run if you just get a Wi-Fi router.
Yeah.
They're incredibly cheap. You can get a $20 one, and you know, you're talking what? 5 trips to Starbucks.
Yeah. So, and if you, another instance where you might want to do this too is if you have one of the laptops that has 3G and you're mm-hmm. using internet, whether it's allowable or not is another story. Mm-hmm. But you could use internet connection sharing to get, like, you know, your phone or some other little device that you want to get on your Kindle or something to go through the PC to use your
if you have a Wi-Fi only Kindle, you're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or some kind of Wi-Fi only device. All right, so yeah, that's how you can do that. So next question, is it possible to lock the desktop in Windows 7 and have it continue to display your desktop wallpaper rather than the default Windows 7 locked workstation screen?
Not in the way that you would normally say it. You have to actually change the background to the lock desktop.
And is that exposed, or do you have to use like a
There's a group policy that you can set for it.
Okay.
Oddly enough, because we just got this question this morning, I don't remember it off the top of my head.
Yeah.
But I can post the location in the
show notes.
In the show notes.
Okay.
But it is technically possible to do. If you want to match your background, you can definitely do that.
And I know I've used some utilities. I think one is StarDock, which is a reputable company.
You used to have to do that for Vista.
Yeah.
You used to have to use third-party stuff for Vista. You don't have to do that in Win 7 anymore.
Yeah. Okay.
It's not designed for the end user. You know, full caveat, full disclosure. It's not designed for end user changing. It was designed for enterprises to set up their workstations in a particular way. Set up for OEMs so that they could have a customized lock screen for their machines that they delivered. But, you know, we're saying that, yes, you can use it as an end user. Don't necessarily count on the fact that it's going to be in the exact same way forever.
Yeah. Okay. Excellent. All right. So next question. I've got a tablet that has 2 equal-sized screens, Acer Arconia, that runs Windows 7. How can I rotate the screens easily without a button to do it, a batch file or a utility? One to turn it sideways, another to turn it back. Is there a good PDF reader that handles, this is 2 questions, multi-part. Is there also a good PDF reader that handles dual screens so that I can have one page on one side, another page on the other side?
I just want to bring up a picture of the Acer Arconia.
Yes, I played with this at CES. This is one of my favorite PCs of all time. And some people love it. Some people are not fans of it. I really liked it. And, you know, I don't know if I could, you know, really get into having a touchscreen keyboard like that in a laptop form.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd like to try. The cool thing with this is, you know, when you're web browsing and you have the web page just scrolls all the way down, and it's so nice. It's got touch. If you want to bring up the keyboard.
So it's not just a keyboard on the screen.
No, it's normally just an all screen.
So it's all screen.
Yeah,
okay,
so it's like having multi-monitor.
And so is a single monitor literally with a hinge?
No, it's 2 monitors with a hinge. Technically 2 monitors. I meant to check this out when I was at CES and I forgot, but I wanted to right-click and see if it shows in screen display whether it has 2, but I'm pretty sure it's like 2 monitors.
Mm-hmm.
But if you want to bring up the keyboard on this thing, you just put 10 fingers down and it pops up the keyboard. And
you have to do all 10? Can you do like 4 or 5?
No, you have to do all 10. You do all 10 fingers. What if you only have 9 fingers?
Yeah, well, I didn't necessarily want to say that, but like, you know, I know of some typists that are like seek and destroy, you know?
Yeah.
Or hunt and peckers.
I'm sure there's another way to bring up the keyboard.
I'm hoping there
might be
a
setting. I need one of these to test with. We have to test all these things here. But yeah, it's very cool. And there's another, I think if you put 5 fingers down, it brings up like a media application down below, which is just, it's super cool. I really like this thing.
Apparently you only need one hand when you're watching movies.
Well, you can set like, you know, hey, I want to work on my, or change my MP3s or something like that. Change your music or, you know, it shows you, I think it was like a display that showed, you know, like a Windows Media Player interface or something like that, but it was their own branded one.
You know what I want with this sucker? Turn it sideways and have Virtual DJ on it.
Yeah, that would be awesome.
Virtual Touch Table DJ on a single machine like that. That would be amazing.
This is really affordable, too. I think I saw it online for under $1,000, too, which I was just amazed at.
Well, with a good MIDI mixer, you know, you're getting up there with 800, 900 just on the mixer alone.
Yeah.
So if you can actually, if this has really good touch response, if it could be used with virtual turntables, you know, Traktor, virtual DJ, anything, like if it can actually be well used, that would be amazing.
I played with it for about 20 minutes, and it was phenomenal. Hmm. So I really liked it. And I've heard that they have a lot of these. You can find them in the Microsoft stores and malls. So if you want to go try one out, you can go there and check it out. Yeah. So anyway, what the person wants to do with this is turn it sideways and have the screens rotate. And I guess I'm surprised there's not a function on there to rotate the screens. Mm-hmm. But what you can do is if your display adapter supports it, you can use Control Alt Right Left Arrow. Mm-hmm. And that'll rotate your screens for you. I'm not sure if it'll rotate both the screens because, you know, you got a multi-monitor thing.
Yeah, screen it'll rotate.
Yeah.
Since I haven't played with this ever, it's actually, I think, the second time I've seen it.
Yeah.
You'd really want to have to check the support page for Acer to see if they have any kind of hotkey combination that'll rotate it.
Yeah.
But I'm actually kind of surprised it doesn't have, you know, an accelerometer that will... or a gyroscope where you rotate it, it'll automatically switch.
And I'm not so sure that it doesn't, and maybe it's just disabled on this person's machine.
Check for a hardware button.
Yeah. All right, so lots to find out about this, and now I have to get one of these to start testing with it. But, so they want to be able to turn it sideways, and then they want to have one page of a PDF on one side, another page of the PDF on the other side. And the way that you could do that is you can just, you know, you can maximize your PDF reader and then stretch it all the way across and do a two-page display
layout.
And it should work fine on this. I don't see any reason why it wouldn't unless the display adapter won't let you rotate the screen.
I mean, if you can use it as a book, right? So if you flip it, turn it 90 degrees, use it as a book, it should automatically rotate everything.
Yeah.
I don't see why it wouldn't.
Yeah, and if you can do multi-monitor on it, mm-hmm. One of the other things you can do, too, is, I mean, you might want to try Ultramon because it'll let you do a full-screen app mm-hmm. that's like, you know, full-screen with no Chrome or anything like that. So that might be an option you want to try with their preview.
No guarantees on what Ultramon will do to this machine.
Yeah. Well, now
this is complex.
And again, I got to get one to test with, so now I'm going to have to check one of these out. But yeah, awesome machine. All right, let's see here. Next question. The default all programs selection of the Windows 7 Start menu is overly cluttered. When I right-click on an item, select delete, I'm prompted for an admin password. Is something misconfigured, or does one really need the admin password to remove, for instance, Windows Live Messenger from all programs submenu? It appears that removing an item from this menu removes it from the Start menu of all users. Can a user not have his own custom Start menu in Windows 7? So, yeah, let's talk a little bit about that, because that's true. You can have different Start menus for every user. Mm-hmm. And if you delete it from your Start menu and mm-hmm. it's deleted for everybody, then it wasn't in a single user's Start menu.
Exactly. So, I mean, I just right-clicked on one of my program groups that I have in my Start menu and checked the properties of it. You notice that it lives in program data.
Yeah.
Okay. So this is the all user Start menu.
Mm-hmm.
If I wanted to delete that, and I wasn't if I didn't have my full administrative token, which means I wasn't already elevated or I wasn't logged in as a built-in admin,
mm-hmm.
Then it would ask me for elevation or it would deny me access if I was just a standard user.
Yeah.
And this is exactly the way that it should work.
Exactly. Right? Yeah.
So you got to remember that the Start menu all programs view is a merged view.
Yeah.
It's a view of your Start menu, your individual Start menu. I'll see if I've
the user that's logged in, as well as all users.
Exactly. I believe this one is an app that I have that installs. Yes. So this is my user Start menu.
Yeah. So it starts with the user's Gove.
Yeah.
And so one of the things that you can do, let's say you want to get rid of an icon that shows up for everybody and mm-hmm. you just want it to show up for you.
Mm-hmm.
The way that you would do that is you can click on the Start menu and go through, right click, open up, and do open in, you know, open or open in new folder if there, it's there. And then you want to get one that has all users, mm-hmm. and then you want to get one that's your user,
and
then
move
just
it.
Drag it to yours, yep. and that'll give you that icon just on that one user or on the whatever user it is that you want.
Yeah, and most applications or many applications during their setup, they'll give you the choice of
yeah.
do you want to install it just for me or do you want to install it for all users on the system?
Yeah, everyone or just me.
Right.
It's and radio buttons.
You can set that during setup and say if you don't just want it for you, then it won't put icons in the start menu group for everybody.
Yeah. Cool. All right. Let's see here. Pick of the week. Pick of the week time. So the pick of the week for me this week is the Visual Studio Achievements. And it might be under your Explorer.
Yes.
There you go. So this is something that the Coding for Fun team did. So I know Karsten was in on this, Clint Ruckus, Dan Fernandez, Jeff Sandquist. These, they were all working on a system that they saw. And this comes from a post that was on Reddit, where a Reddit user said, wouldn't it be awesome if you could get achievements in like Visual Studio? So not only did they make this happen, which is very cool. I mean, like if you do 100,000 lines of code, you get the big coder achievement or whatever it is. I don't know what the achievements are. There's interrupting cow here. But
potty mouth award for using five different curse words in a single file. Yeah, I don't think that's a very good achievement, though.
Well, it depends. So anyway, there's a ton of achievements, and yeah, it's awesome. And the really cool thing about this is they made an API, so if you want to add achievements to your application, you can code those in yourself. So
okay.
Like you can have, if you want to do it for like Ultramon, you can have rotated 100 times or something like that.
Well, you know the only achievements that I want, right?
I can't imagine.
Bug-free code.
Yay,
no double freeze.
Yeah, compiled with no errors.
Exactly.
I know there's one where I think there's an achievement for if you compile and there's 100 errors. And then I think there's another one where you compiled something that did have 100 errors and now it has no errors or something like that. So there's like just all kinds of achievements in there, and it's all kinds of fun. So
I want the achievement of, you know, you made Gove happy. You made Gove
you
sad.
You saved Gove some serious time. Awesome. So yeah, check it out. And you know, if you're making your own application, this is something you might want to add to it. Yeah, you can of course use it with games. You can use it with applications, whatever, just to kind of gamify things and make your experience enjoyable for everyone using it. So that's one. The next one that we want to talk about.
This is really cool. I just thought of it for another thing. You want to get like telemetry on how your application is used, right? If you've coded in some Easter eggs into your application, you know, some fun aspects of your game, and you can figure out, hey, is anybody even getting to this?
Yeah, interesting.
That would be a really cool way of seeing, you know, what users are doing with your application.
Yeah, and you can also post these on Facebook, too. So if you want to show, you know, how awesome of a coder you are with all your achievements, you can just post them to Facebook as well. So, and Twitter, of course. So the next one, pick of the week, is an infographic here. And this is for Data Privacy Day, which I believe is in 2 days, and this will air after that day. But I think you and I are probably two of the biggest privacy advocates I've ever met. So
I definitely do value my privacy.
I do. And until I started at Microsoft, there was not a single footprint of me online for the most part. I think there was like two articles that I wrote and a book I wrote that mentioned me.
Mm-hmm.
But I had like no footprint. And people would say, well, why don't you put like, you know, all kinds of stuff about you on the web? And I was like, well, you can't unring the bell. So I was just very cautious about that. And I'm very cautious about what I put about myself online. And mm-hmm. So this is an article we'll link to. Check it out. It tells you about, you know, some of the negative consequences of having too much information out there. And they have some stats, like, you know, 21% of the 5,000 people interviewed or asked about this were fired from a job because of something that was posted about them online, whether they did it or someone else did.
Remember,
that seems like a high number.
Remember, right, it's not about just what information you put online, it's how things are correlated.
Yeah.
Like, that's the other aspect of privacy, right, is you could put a piece of information online and have it intended for a certain group of people.
Yeah.
Then you have different pieces of information that are put online intended for different groups of different people. And when those start intersecting, mm-hmm. if they're no longer kept separate, if they're no longer in the areas in which you have designated them to be in,
yeah,
then there becomes a much larger problem of, you know, you being correlated amongst multiple data sources, being able to get a much better real-time representation of yourself online,
yeah,
in ways that you had never even thought possible.
Yeah.
You know, like every time you go to a store, you know, what you, things that you've purchased, if you buy stuff online, different places you might go online might start sharing data that might get sold off to different ad companies. You,
mm-hmm,
might, you know, there's just kind of a snowball effect to the kinds of things that you do online.
And I think it's one of these things where also if you have kids, you need to bring them up understanding how the world,
absolutely,
has changed. I mean, once you make a mistake, sometimes you can't change it.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is something you just want to ingrain into kids growing up, that you want to be very careful about what you stick online. Sometimes it's impossible to remove it once it's been posted. So, yeah, and I'd like to find out more about this. I want to read the full report on this, but like 15% were turned down for a mortgage. I wonder, how do they know that that was an indicator, that was a, mm-hmm, factor in that decision? Were you just turned down for a mortgage, or was it because of something that you had online?
Right.
So, and then I know with me, there's another Larry Larson out there who's a bass fisherman. He's wrote tons of books about bass fishing. And so whenever you do a search for Larry Larson, he's the one you come up with.
Which do you know anything about bass fishing?
No, I don't. I know nothing about it. But I think he lived in Florida, too, like I did. So I liked it because for a lot of years, he was my internet blast shield. He was the guy who kept me from, like, having anything on the internet, because all you would find is just bass fishing stuff.
Nice.
And there was another Larry Larson who was one of the kids on the Mickey Mouse Club. So
yeah, I think you're too great. Young. You're too young.
You do
for
a
that
search
one,
for
you?
Me, and I got mouse ears. Someone's got mouse ears on. So, yeah. So, data privacy. Know it, love it, learn it. Make sure that you know it
be
inside and out.
Be conscious of it.
Teach your kids about this. All things have changed in this world, so it's important to know. All right. So that's the show for this week. If you want to write us, you can write us at defragshow@microsoft.com. Send us an email or leave a message in the comments. We can get back to you. We prefer email so we can do a little back and forth if we have to. And we'll see you next week.
Take care.